Before I get to the message, I want to finish reading from the passage that we've begun. So, still on page 1078 in the church turquoise Bibles, we read from chapter 11, verse 38 to verse 44. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth round his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." I like a good television mystery, especially if it's British made. Already during our time in Israel, if I could catch Inspector Morse, Midsummer Murders, or even an Agatha Christie mystery, I was happy. With this in mind, you will not be surprised to learn that I number among the many fans of BBC's hit mystery, Sherlock, starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. Despite this, I do have a major complaint. It's not that the dialogue, action, and images move so rapidly, or that we get only 3 90-minute episodes every 2 years or so, or even that with the long gap between seasons, it's hard to connect past events with current plots. These are minor complaints. My major grievance focuses squarely on season 3, episode 1. Spoiler alert. If you've not seen the end of season 2 or the beginning of season 3 and you don't want me to ruin the suspense, please stop listening. And we'll try to signal you when you can start listening again in a few minutes. At the end of season 2, Sherlock is forced by his arch nemesis, Moriarty, to choose between saving his own life and sacrificing himself in a very public suicide in order to save the lives of his friends. Heroically, Sherlock jumps to his death from atop St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, and the season ends with him dead and with his friends, who haven't a clue as to his motives, in a state of shocked grief. Now, no sooner had the episode finished airing than social media was alive with theories as to how Sherlock could have faked his death. Given the show's popularity and the fact that its renewal for a third season was announced immediately after the end of season 2, there was never really any doubt that Sherlock would be back. There was even a 7-minute-long special internet episode between seasons 2 and 3 teasing our hero's return. In January 2014, season 3 kicked off with the episode, "The Empty Hearse." Sherlock, show and character both, had indeed returned, and fans, myself included, were very pleased to have the two back. Indeed, as an American, I was perhaps more relieved than most, since our longest wait after a season-ending cliffhanger is typically no more than 3 or 4 months. Here, it had been an excruciating 2 years. And I was as eager as the next fan for the answer to the big question. How had Sherlock staged his death? And herein lies my biggest complaint, for we are never told how he did it. It's not that we're given no explanation, we're shown 3 of them. But we quickly realize that none of these is likely to be the truth. To make matters worse, Sherlock boasts of having contrived no fewer than 13 ways of faking his death. In the end, we are left with only the apparent fact of Sherlock's death, a certain fact of his survival, and the ongoing frustration of being unable to reconcile the two. This non-resolution left me sorely disappointed. Not sufficiently disappointed, mind you, to stop watching the show, but disappointed nonetheless. As dissatisfied as I was, things could have been worse. Sherlock might have really died. The show might have been canceled, leaving us in perpetual doubt as to Sherlock's condition. Another possibility, one that would have left me feeling positively cheated, I think, is if Sherlock had physically died and then been miraculously resurrected. Not only would this have been jarring, since it doesn't fit the fictional world depicted in this series, it would also arguably have reflected a lack of creative genius on the part of the show's writers. Given the complex nature of the cases typically faced by Sherlock and Watson, that particular solution would be too easy. All things being equal, we expect a problem solution to follow the regular laws of nature. Unless, that is, the backstory of the fictional world of our characters includes magic. For example, we do not feel cheated when the supernatural is cleverly employed to help resolve problems in Middle-earth, Narnia, or at Hogwarts. Also, even in our world, not all problems seem to have a natural solution. From discussions I've had with unbelieving friends and some reading I've done over the past year, it seems to me that many people, including Christians, feel a disappointment with Christianity's answers to life's problems, similar to what I might have felt had Sherlock literally died and been brought back to life. Now you can tell the people to start listening again. I've done talking about Sherlock. Miracles are all well and good in fantasy worlds, people say, but our problems require real-life solutions. It's worth noting that our everyday worldviews do tend to have room for non-material things as well. Feelings, concepts, philosophy, ethics, morals, logic, and in the case of some of us here, geometrical theorems and mathematical equations. But probably because these things can't be picked up and handled, to most people they seem somehow less factual than material reality. And as for a supernatural or spiritual dimension within reality, who knows if it even exists, much less if interacting with it can be of any help to us. The Bible cannot be read as neutral on this question. According to its take on reality, the natural physical world that we can see and touch and test and measure is not the whole show. There also exists an unseen supernatural or spiritual part of reality, which, we are assured, despite all appearances to the contrary, is no less real, indeed is a great deal more real, than the physical world. Since we are generally unable to perceive this spiritual reality with our physical senses, accepting it as real requires faith. And since it can be hard to accept the reality of something invisible, living by faith is often difficult. For example, I am convinced that my children would be quicker to wash their hands before dinner if the germs on their fingers were big enough to see. As it is, they have more or less to wash by faith. Now, while faith in God necessarily includes a very personal element involving our own private experiences, in the case of Christianity, much of faith boils down to simple, though not necessarily unexamined, trust in a set of ancient writings that recount God's special revelation to particular people. This is worth spelling out because the intimate link that is supposed to connect faith and truth has frequently been misunderstood or even denied throughout history, even by Christians. For instance, we should resist defining faith as nobly maintaining belief in something that cannot possibly be true, as if faith's efficacy depended principally on our powers of self-delusion. The most important component of Christian faith is not the strength of our conviction. Jesus says we actually need very little faith, but rather the object of our conviction. Our faith works because it corresponds in some fundamental way to reality. It's required because we simply can't see all of reality. The biblical writers tell us about God and about how we ought to interact with him when, to judge from all appearances, we might conclude that there is no God and no reality beyond the physical. And so we come to John chapter 11, in which Jesus and his followers, and we with them, confront what is perhaps humanity's greatest source of fear and sorrow, precisely because it is a problem with no natural solution. As regards duration and quality of life, there is no doubt that we are medically far better off than ever before. I am regularly amazed at the continued advances in medicine that I read about and have no reason to doubt continued progress. though for all I know, there may be reasons for doubt. The rise of antibiotic-resistant forms of known illnesses is troubling. At all events, in the case of one particular health problem, we have made no advance in relation to the ancients. As much as we may want one, modern science still has no remedy for death. We are better than ever at staving it off, but we cannot prevent it indefinitely, and once it happens, we can't undo it. Now, the fact that we want a cure for death in no way guarantees that there is or ever will be one. We all know that merely wishing something doesn't make it so. But if there is a solution for death, it seems to me that it's more likely to be of the supernatural sort than of the natural variety. Deterioration and decomposition seem to be the way of things in biology, and even if death could be indefinitely postponed, could decay be halted? I'm intrigued by the idea that our minds might someday be uploaded, stored, and backed up, then downloaded into new brains. But this would still just be holding off death. And in any case, I'm pretty sure we'd mess it up. Computer viruses, information breaches, and just plain glitches due to poor programming are already rampant. Just think what would happen if these affected our stored minds. And we think that identity theft is a nuisance now. Putting aside the science fiction of mind uploading, on which I might add Wikipedia has a very informative entry, I think we can agree that humanity goes through life very much in the looming shadow of death. Let's get on to our text. I've divided what I have to say into four parts. I'll begin with some points from here and there in our chapter, before focusing on the three main elements of the central statement in verse 25. When we survey the motivations of the various participants in the story, we see a common thread, the desire to avoid disaster. Mary, Martha, and the people of Bethany all say that the current disaster, Lazarus' death, could have been prevented had Jesus only arrived earlier. For their part, the disciples are also intent on trying to avert disaster. They are all too aware that some in and around Jerusalem have become displeased with Jesus and recall that on a previous occasion, violence had almost ensued. Jesus is still relatively young. He has really only just begun what promises to be a long and fruitful ministry of teaching and healing, from which the disciples themselves and others are clearly benefiting, and the disciples are keen to ensure this continue. He might even bring about real change on the political scene. They are understandably concerned for Jesus and their own safety and well-being. Jesus, by contrast, seems positively unconcerned, or worse, to have some sort of death wish. He appears actively to be courting disaster. After refusing to set out at once upon hearing of his friend's illness, and thereby contributing at least partially to the disaster of Lazarus' death, when it's already too late, he's suddenly and inexplicably determined to head for Jerusalem, the place where he will be in the most danger. All Christians, at one time or another, confront the problem of reconciling God's existence with the reality of the suffering that he allows. A lot has been written on what is technically called theodicy, but we'll content ourselves with the rather simple answers given in the text. In verse 4, Jesus says, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God might receive glory." And in verse 15, "And as for you, I am glad that I wasn't there, that you might believe." Admittedly, Jesus' words in verse 4 sound at best wrong and at worst dishonest. Certainly the disciples would have understood him to be foretelling Lazarus' recovery when he said, "This sickness is not unto death." In hindsight, of course, we can reinterpret the phrase to mean, "This sickness is not ultimately unto death, but for God's glory." In other words, Jesus says that, even if currently unfathomable, the present suffering can be made to produce still greater good. This applies both to Lazarus' death and its effects, and later to Jesus' own sacrifice and its greater effects, but it also speaks to us in our problems. At one time or another, we all confront difficulties, whether in the form of mere inconveniences or unmitigated catastrophes with lasting consequences. And it is natural to ask, why? Why me? Why this? Why now? I don't think God minds the questions, so long as we really are requesting information. Because there are two ways to pose them. One is as a rhetorical complaint, in which why is more accusation than question. It would be more honest to say, God, you have messed up. Or God, this is not what I need. Or God, you are failing to take good care of me. The other way is more thoughtful and reflects genuine interest in an answer, a real desire to understand God's ways. God, this really hurts. I'm honestly not sure how you're going to get me through it. I wonder what it is you want to teach me or others. Can you reveal to me, if not now, then at least sometime down the road, what possible good you can bring from this? We are not to ignore, even downplay, the reality of the problems we and others face. Jesus does not. We note in verse 35 that he weeps. But we should try to see them in the correct proportion. Our trials can be enormous, complicated, even permanent. But there is great comfort available if we can just internalize the threefold truth that God knows what he's doing, has the power to bring it about, and in all that he does, has our best interest in view. Now, I realize that Jesus' line about receiving glory might smack of self-aggrandizement, because that's generally the case when we seek glory. But this isn't the case with Jesus, and it isn't even always the case with us. For reasons I won't elaborate, over the last 2 years, I have become rather more familiar than I'd have liked with Addenbrooke's pediatric clinic. Despite this, I still have trouble distinguishing nurses from doctors. They're all often dressed in scrubs of various colors that might, for all I know, be color-coded. But if they are, I've not yet figured out the scheme. So when, after what is typically a rather lengthy wait, a doctor finally appears and introduces him or herself by saying, "Hello, I'm Dr. So-and-so," though the title doctor certainly does command a degree of respect, I do not feel in the least that they are trying to garner undue attention or honor. I'm happy they've identified themselves. It's for our benefit, so that we know that they are the ones best qualified to help us. I think it's similar with God. His desire for glory is probably best understood as a desire for recognition, in the most basic sense of that word, namely that we recognize him for who he is and for what he can do and act accordingly. And just as in the case of the doctor, while he may indeed enjoy taking care of us, we doubtless derive far more benefit from the arrangement than he does. Jesus has some other rather cryptic statements here. In verses 9 and 10, "Are there not 12 hours in a day?" is best understood in light of the ancient concept of the 12-hour workday. Jesus is evidently saying that though his hour is near, there is still time for him to work, and he is going to take advantage of the opportunity. Verse 10, "Whoever goes about in the day does not stumble because they see the light of the world, but whoever goes about at night stumbles because they do not have the light within," extends the imagery connected with the light of day and seems to come in response to the disciples' hesitancy to follow Jesus on what seems a most counterintuitive course of action. He appears to be saying something like, "You think you're going to fall if you follow me on this rocky, on the rocky path I'm walking, but I am the light, and only if you stay with me, no matter how counterintuitive doing so seems, will you see not to stumble. By walking your own apparently smoother path, though, however sensible that may seem, you will be walking in darkness, and you will fall." So much of the Christian life, beliefs, thoughts, desires, opinions, goals, words, deeds, runs counter to natural inclinations, to conventional human wisdom, and to cultural norms, no matter when and where Christians live. Though we may want our differences from the dominant culture to appear stylishly nonconformist, my sense is that we more often just seem weird, backward, and woefully out of touch. It really makes no sense to follow Jesus, unless he is, as he says, the light of the world, in which case nothing could be more reasonable. I'm encouraged by the fact that we don't actually need to understand all that much to obey. In our passage, it's not one of the apostolic greats who first responds to Jesus, not Peter, James, or John, but doubting Thomas, who says in verse 16, "Let us all go that we might die with him." And though Martha always seems to play second fiddle to Mary, I find Martha's faith here inspiring. Presumably overcome with sorrow at the loss of her brother and possibly even disillusioned with regard to Jesus and his timing, she remains convinced of Jesus' goodness and authority. Though she may have been vulnerable to despair, her mindset is sufficiently open to hope and faith that she can say not just, "If you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died," which might sound plaintive, but also, "Even now I know that God will grant you whatever you ask. And I know that my brother will rise again on the last day. And yes, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." I like Thomas and Martha precisely because they are so human, so obviously flawed and bewildered, but still exhibit genuine and even exemplary devotion. Faith can seem comparatively easy when things are going smoothly, but an integral element of faith is faithfulness, constancy, persistence, firmness, endurance, and our most profound and meaningful understandings of what it means to trust Jesus often come in the midst of intense and or prolonged periods of suffering and struggle. In these situations, we are made painfully aware of our own insufficiency and have the opportunity to rely on God's all-sufficiency. Of course, there is no direct correlation between suffering and faith. Some struggle, whether for shorter or longer times, and end up losing faith. And by losing faith, I don't necessarily mean that you've stopped believing in God or rebelled in some obvious way. Perhaps you've just given up on the idea that God really can satisfy and fulfill you, that God's best for you really is the absolute best, that in spite of it all, he really does know what he's doing. I regularly struggle with this, if not in theory, then certainly in practice. I wonder if this is not part of the reason that Jesus wept. Since he was mere moments from bringing Lazarus back to life, it seems unlikely that he was just mourning the dead. He may well have been moved by the people's grief, by compassion at their suffering, and he quite possibly also identified with our more general helplessness in the face of death. It is telling that he makes no attempt to quell the people's expression of grief, but joins in. It is not inconceivable that his sorrow was greater than theirs, since he could perceive the spiritual effects of their sadness, how close they may have been to despair, that they were perhaps growing incredulous of God's capacity for good, even in the very presence of his son. Nobody is immune to losing confidence in God's love and kindness and provision, but it's important to recognize that faith can be restored. We can allow ourselves to be convinced anew, not just of God's care for us, but of his power to act in our best interest. There is a degree of comfort to be found in a Savior capable of empathizing with us in our suffering. There is far more to be found in a Savior who has conquered the reason for the suffering. Thinking about Jesus' willingness to serve as God's sacrifice helps us to confront another issue, one that is seldom raised in sermons, but which I trust will be useful. Christians are often surprised to discover that the Gospel of John is viewed by many as the most anti-Semitic of New Testament books. This is because it regularly refers to Jesus' antagonists collectively as the Jews, as in verse 8 of our chapter. This has, in turn, partially fueled the traditional European belief that all Jews are Christ killers. Many Jews and others, of course, reject the accusation, arguing that it was the Romans who crucified Jesus. We might call this the blame the Italians defense. Having married into an Italian family, I'm not wholly unsympathetic to this line of argumentation. Indeed, in other contexts, I have used it myself. And in this particular case, it is technically true. But if the Romans were the gun, then a particular segment of the Jewish population of first century Palestine certainly helped pull the trigger. But what to do with John's blanket statements, apparently lumping all Jews together as enemies of Jesus? I think there are only two promising lines of argumentation. According to one, since the book's author was Jewish, did not deny that Jesus and his disciples were all Jews, and was writing for a still largely Jewish community, this target audience would have understood the Jews as shorthand for some less inclusive subgroup, probably the authoritative representatives of Judaism and many of their followers. The main point being that the writer viewed the conflicts between Jesus and his adversaries as inner Jewish disputes. Any antisemitism that later readers might perceive is due to reading the book into the book an ethos unknown to its original audience. The other point to consider is that whoever was involved in Jesus' crucifixion and whatever blame each individually bears, according to the biblical account, responsibility ultimately lies with God himself. This was no unanticipated calamity. At the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, John the Baptist, at least partially aware of Jesus' destiny, identifies him in unmistakable sacrificial imagery as the Lamb of God. Later on, Jesus himself says that he lays down his life. And while it is often remarked that the Jewish crowd that cried out for Jesus' death also called down a curse upon themselves and upon their descendants, it is just as true that from the cross, Jesus asked his Father to forgive those involved in his execution. To whom is the Father more likely to have listened? In Acts 2:23, Peter tells his fellow Jews, "This man who was handed over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you executed by nailing him to a cross at the hands of Gentiles." Jesus' death was at God's own initiative. The single greatest human contribution is our sin in need of redemption, which characterized both Jew and Gentile alike. I would like now to move to the exchange between Jesus and Martha in verses 23 through 26 that seems to lie at the heart of the chapter, starting with the concept of resurrection. Beginning in verse 23, Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, he who believes in me will live, even though he dies, and the one who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" Do you believe this? This is the question I was asked in private by a student of mine, an avowed atheist, who spent a few months living at Tyndale House at the end of last year. She'd been shocked to discover that there were still believing Christians in the world. You see how far things have gone. It's not just that they no longer believe in God, they don't believe in us anymore either. My student's biggest problem with Christianity was not what she considered its confining moral absolutism, though this certainly bothered her, but the fact that she found it all so unbelievable. She did not believe there was any God, and she was even more certain about the impossibility of miracles. She was educated and matter-of-fact with her feet firmly planted on the ground, and she was convinced that we, her approachable, reasonably clever, if somewhat backward Christian contacts, were deluding ourselves with a form of fantasy. One thing this student did understand was that belief in God, the supernatural, and the afterlife was an essential part of Christianity. Or, put another way, that Christianity without God and miracles is a silly waste of time, or worse. Some people are attracted to church for the perceived moral and social benefits, exposing their children to Judeo-Christian ethics, having a support system, socializing, counseling, learning a language, etc. Some might experience an emotional or even vaguely spiritual benefit, a sense that something here resonates with that part of them that they suspect transcends the material world. There is nothing wrong with this as far as it goes. What is wrong is to expect no more than this. There's certainly no fault in supposing that living according to God's wisdom should help you lead a happier, more meaningful life than would otherwise be possible, even with the troubles you may experience as a result of your faith. Functioning according to our manufacturer's instructions ought to result in optimum performance. But there's more to it than that. As many of you know, our middle child, Yoel, suffers from an autism spectrum disorder. He often developed prolonged obsessions of sorts. One of the most persistent of these focused on the 20th Century Fox film intro. Yes, that one. The one with the drum roll and trumpets. Yoel spent over a year fixating on this. In addition to watching various renditions on YouTube, he would routinely play videos just long enough to see the intro, then rewind and rewatch again and again. Over the years, various people have evidently put significant amounts of time and effort into developing each new edition of the intro, and there must be very few people in the history of cinema who appreciate their work more than Yoel does. And I'll admit it, to some degree, I also came rather to enjoy the combination of stability and variety, consistency in the general pattern, with slight freshness in each new version. Despite this, and though the pleasure Yoel derived from watching it was readily apparent, I couldn't help but feel that he wasn't really getting the full benefit of the videos that he was playing. People had, it is true, put a lot of work into that intro, but they'd invested even more in the rest of the films, which were the real point of the cinema experience. I think many people do something similar with Christianity. They satisfy themselves with the ethical, social, and communal niceties, either not realizing or being unable to accept that God has a lot more to offer. Jesus here says, "I am the resurrection," and lest anybody be tempted to interpret this as somehow strictly spiritual, goes on physically to raise from the dead a person who's been 4 days in the tomb. I'm not sure that we ought to go about ranking miracles, but along with creation itself and possibly the whole incarnation / virgin birth episode, we are talking about a miracle par excellence. Okay, parting the Red Sea is pretty good too. And if you need confirmation that yes, the resurrection is an essential component of the Christian faith, you have only to recall the words of the Apostle Paul from 1 Corinthians 15. In summary, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is useless. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. I take this to mean that the one thing on which all the other good in Christianity hangs is the concept that God is stronger than death. If this is so, then whatever else we're about in the church, we must not lose central focus on this. And while we might very well expect and even welcome a certain degree of variety within modern Christianity, no form of it should be reduced to a neutral, non-invasive, domesticated life philosophy from which the antiquated and now intellectually offensive belief in the supernatural has been safely removed. If we've accepted the truth of the gospel primarily because it somehow improves or enriches our present existence, because following its precepts makes us marginally better people and helps us cope more effectively in the world, while it certainly does these things, we are missing a good deal of the point. And do we really want to settle for solutions to our biggest problems that are less than supernatural? Isn't something miraculous exactly what we need? With all due respect to our scientists, engineers, researchers, and clinicians, with, and I say this in all seriousness, their truly remarkable advances in science, technology, medicine, and psychology, certain problems just seem too big for human intelligence and ingenuity to overcome. The Bible views death as one of these. Unable to manage on our own, we are in need of an outside specialist. This is why God's power over death manifests in Jesus' resurrection of Lazarus, who eventually died again, and later and more definitively in his own permanent resurrection, is so central to the Christian faith and to reality more generally. In terms of giving life, God's proven track record makes him the preeminent specialist in the field. Now, if you balk intellectually at the possibility of resurrection, you are not alone. It is sometimes said that the New Testament writers accepted the reality of resurrection only because first century people had a pre-Enlightenment, unscientific view, and so were far more susceptible than we to superstition and old wives' tales. In response to this, I want to read an excerpt from a book by Tim Keller. on the issue of explaining the scriptural evidence for Jesus' resurrection, he writes, "I sympathize with the person who says, 'So what if I can't think of an alternate explanation? The resurrection just couldn't happen.' Let's not forget, however, that first century people felt exactly the same way. They found the resurrection just as inconceivable as you do. The only way anyone embraced the resurrection back then was by letting the evidence challenge and change their worldview, their view of what was possible. They had just as much trouble with the claims of the resurrection as you, yet the evidence, both of the eyewitness accounts and the changed lives of Christ's followers, was overwhelming. Each year at Easter, I get to preach on the resurrection. In my sermon, I always say to my skeptical secular friends that even if they can't believe in the resurrection, they should want it to be true. Most of them care deeply about justice for the poor, alleviating hunger and disease, and caring for the environment. Yet many of them believe that the material world was caused by accident, and that the world and everything in it will eventually simply burn up in the death of the sun. They find it discouraging that so few people care about justice without realizing that their own worldview undermines any motivation to make the world a better place. Why sacrifice for the needs of others if in the end nothing we do will make any difference? If the resurrection of Jesus happened, however, that means there's infinite hope and reason to pour ourselves out for the needs of the world." He then quotes N.T. Wright, "The message of the resurrection is that this world matters, that the injustices and pains of this present world must now be addressed with the news that healing, justice, and love have won." And what if scientists did manage to overcome death? What if humanity somehow found a way indefinitely to preserve a person's life, whether by mind uploading or cryonics or some other technology? It's interesting that Jesus' declaration includes two elements, resurrection and life. Evidently, basic run-of-the-mill resurrection is inadequate. We need new life as well. I began this evening by sharing with you my fondness of television mysteries. I'm also a fan of other genres. But one sort of program I do not like is zombie shows. Even so, I think we can learn a valuable lesson from zombies, and it's that simple reanimation isn't all that great. I mentioned before that humanity lives under the looming shadow of death. It may be our greatest fear, but I don't think it's actually our biggest problem. Death, at least the way we experience it, is evidently just the result of a more basic, more radical issue, and in a nutshell, it's that we're not really very nice creatures. Whatever we were meant to be, it's not this. We've gone wrong. And I think we all sense it. Even at our most joyful moments, we are conscious that joy is fleeting. Even at the height of our success, we are a lapse in judgment from crushing failure. Even in moments of love and selflessness and altruism, we are a hair's breadth from hate and selfishness and indifference. And it's not just that the world around us or everybody else are the problem. If we're honest, we will see and admit that we ourselves are not as we should be, wherever we get the idea of should. And so overcoming death by prolonging life, as great as that sounds, would still leave us with the problem of living on indefinitely with ourselves and with each other and with all the wrong that exists inside of us and comes out of us. And for all of our progress, I see no evidence whatsoever to indicate that humanity has, or left to ourselves, ever will overcome our selfish and destructive inclinations. From prehistory through ancient times, through the Middle Ages till today, in spite of our many political, social, economic, and educational advances, which we must be thankful, do partially restrain certain forms of inhumanity in some places. We are basically the same miserable and misery-causing people we have always been. And our negative impact on the world almost certainly goes beyond ruining the environment. The hurts we cause and endure are not confined just to war-torn or poverty-stricken areas, or to psychopaths and the criminally insane, or to celebrities and politicians. In one way or another, and to whatever degree, and no matter how adept we are at camouflaging it, we are all messed up, broken, and lost. With all this in mind, do we really want mere resurrection, immortality, as it were, without a deep-seated change in life and in us to go along with it? Most people are capable of suffering for a limited amount of time, but could we endure suffering for all eternity? Is that not a partial definition of hell itself? We need resurrection, but we also need a new and improved life, a new and improved us. I argued before that if you are a Christian just for how it can help you in this life, you're missing a good deal of the point. You're stuck on the 20th century Fox intro. But if you're in it just to escape the otherwise negative effects of death, you're still missing out on something. You're waiting to meet the director backstage when you could enjoy working with him, playing a role in the epic film that he's currently directing. Jesus equates himself not just with resurrection, but here and elsewhere with life, and not just any old life, but life abundant. Eternal life is both quantitatively longer and qualitatively better than physical life. And there's an unmistakable immediacy in Jesus' words. Despite life's trials, because the most essential aspect of this new life is a personal relationship with God, the upgrade in quality and the process of the transformation in our character need not be deferred to the distant afterlife, but can start now. To this point, we've seen that Jesus is all about providing a remedy for death and about helping us to get new life. But there is another very particularistic aspect to what he says, and we will conclude with this. The one part of Jesus' pronouncement about resurrection and life upon which we have yet to focus is the fact that Jesus goes so far as to equate himself with the two words, or perhaps to define them in light of himself. Do you want to know who I am? I am the resurrection and life. Do you want to know what resurrection and life are? Look at me. They're found in me. I define them. Whether you're a convinced and committed Christian, call yourself a Christian, but know that you're not much of a believer, view Christianity as absurd, or find yourself wavering somewhere in between, I trust you will agree with me that there is something right in your finding death to be alien and repugnant. I hope you take seriously this desire for immortality. You ought to want life and abundance and eternity, and you ought to want the sort of eternity that goes beyond mere infinite duration and that is characterized by a joy and fullness and fulfillment and vitality that begins now. But the message of our text is that these are just byproducts. It says, recognize it or not, what you really need and want is access to the source of resurrection and life. What your heart longs for is to know your Lord, to submit to his authority, to accept his counsel, to follow him wherever he goes, to sit at his feet, and to rest in his presence. Amen.